Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And if you get tired of hearing me with Anthony, you can always hear him by himself.
That's right, every Friday, 5 to 7, in this time slot.
That's true.
Our wonderful program is produced by the Center for Emerging Media, which was founded by Mark Steiner. Great organization.
And we do our Mondays together, and we are really happy to have with us here Lamar Darnell Shields.
Two great dynamic leaders in our city who unfortunately spend too much time away from our city doing all their great work.
He doesn't know what they have often. Yeah. And the people they have. And David Miller, who will be joining us by phone or dashing in here. He's on Northern Parkway, driving back from New Jersey, where he's also doing work inside the prisons in New Jersey, if I'm correct about mm-hmm. that. Is that right, Lamar?
Yes, yes.
The number here is 410-319-8888. Somebody, David Eberhard, who works in the state prisons, mm-hmm. Brought to our attention in an email the other day, we were going to, about the work that was being done by Lamar mm-hmm. And David and with this group of inmates. And I was so taken by it that I wanted to have been willing to have them on anyway on a more regular basis. This is a good excuse to get them back on the air with us now.
Well, thanks for having me back, man.
It's good to have you here, man. So tell us a bit about this work that we heard about at City Jail that you were doing on self-esteem for the inmates there. What is going on there?
You know, it was interesting. I also read the email that Dave Eberhard sent. If you know anybody knows Dave Eberhard, he is a radical white dude in
crazy,
jail.
Crazy human being, but a good man.
I told him I think they're going to phase his job out when he leaves.
He gives me a lot of grief in emails.
He's a spoken word artist. I mean, he's a comedian. But when he wrote that email, to catch people up, David and I were there maybe 2 weeks ago at the Eager Street side working with a group of inmates that are part of the acupuncture program. These are recovering men who are recovering addicts, probably about 100 men, predominantly African-American, of course, when you look at the prison population. But there were some, actually the oldest guy in there was a white male, was like 60 years old. And we had been doing some work for a while ago. You said that's not that old. I said older. He just called me old. And but it was something special about this time. David and I had been in there. You know, we've gone together. We've gone separately. David had done some work at the Eager Street Academy that actually led to a partnership with the Weinberg Foundation that sort of led into our Praise Academy because they had read about the work that David was doing in the prison. So he would go separately, then I would go, and then we would come together. But it was something, Mark, it was something special about this time that we went. It was a very unique group of men who are in this acupuncture program. I can't think of the particular name of it. It's with through Dave Eberhard and also with the with the librarian who's actually on staff by Baltimore City, and their director, and we were asked to come in to just do a session around engaging these men about some of the issues that they were faced with, and you know, we didn't know where the spirit was going to lead us. We just had this conversation. I started, then David came on, then we sort of, you know, worked together, and the conversation became so fluid that. They say men don't talk, and these men really opened up about some of the challenges that they were actually faced with. And we talked about, you know, it went so well, Anthony, that we said to the men, I'm going to get into the crux of what happened. At the end of the, David and I came with an idea about doing a book club. And these brothers were like, we want to do it. And I was blown away. Yeah, I think it was something that we just threw out there and didn't think that anybody was going to go for. But when we said it, they were like, we would love to do a book club. When do you guys want to get started? And I was like, man, Dave, we done put our foot in our mouth. Now these brothers are going to hold us accountable. They're going to put the word on the street and let us know. You know, some brothers got some cell phones to deal with, right? That's another conversation. They're going to put the word out on the street. But they opened up to us with this activity, but I want to go back to, you know, with the things we were doing, but I want to go back to Dave Eberhard, who brought us there. So Dave Eberhard, this 60-plus-year-old man who's been working in the prison for 30-plus years, Anthony, he participated in the activity. He just wasn't sitting on the sidelines. He participated. And he did this timeline activity that talks about the positive and the negative things that have taken place in your life from age 5 all the way to 25, you know, 5 and then 10 and 15 from your first thought, basically. And Dave participated in this act. Dave Eberhard, who works for the prison. And then he wrote this letter. And then he talked to David and I. He said, man, you know, I'm college educated. I've traveled all over the country. And, boy, I still got some issues that I'm dealing with. So I can only imagine these men. So David led that activity, and he asked about three men to come up to speak again. We say men don't talk. Given the opportunity, we created a safe, emotionally safe, and a physically safe environment. Mm-hmm. At least, you know, because Dave and I tell for we can fight, but I think we might have been outnumbered on that day. Throw some books at some folks, man. But these men came up, Mark, and they went through that timeline. And you know that Paul's is like, man, I got to get myself together, you know, because men aren't supposed to cry, as they say, like men don't talk. But they shared some serious stuff that I was like, I couldn't believe.
Serious stuff about their lives.
About their lives, about the things that happened to them. You know, they didn't blame anybody for them ending up in prison. But they talked about the situations that really helped them be in prison. So the things that people said, your daddy was no good, you're not going to be no good. You know, black males are going to college, are going to jail fast. So they believed all this. You know, many of them couldn't read. So it was a struggle to even articulate. And what David had to really help a guy, and we're going to talk about the activity that we did at the end, he really had to help a guy write his stuff down. But he was open enough to say, man, could you help? Could you spell this for me? And could you do this for me? But I was blown away. So then when we said, let's do this book club, I was like, man, we're on to something. Because we got to remember, Mark, that these men have to come out of prison. So Dave Eberhardt, who sat there, went through the activity, and he says, man, I got some issues that I still have not resolved. And he even said to us that I was blown away that these men opened up to you and David, who they had never met. We told them our stories briefly. I didn't candy coat it. David talked about growing up in Baltimore, talked about growing up in Chicago, and our best friends were killed. And we opened up and we talked about how we ended up. We talked about our thoughts put us where we were. We could have easily gone to jail. And so Dave did this whole thing and he was into it. And I said, wow, we're on to something. We're really on to something. So we threw that carrot out there with the activity. And the brother said we want to do a book club. What makes it so much exciting is that the folks that work there want to do it. They didn't back down. It was like, let's make it happen. Let's make it happen. What's the first book? So we're meeting this week with the folks down there to talk about what's going to be the book, what's going to be the protocol, the literacy issues. Of course, we're going to need, of course, some books on tape because we do have some gentlemen who have some literacy issues. But the fact that they wanted to do it really said a whole lot to me. Now, I don't know what they're going to do when they get out, but the fact that two men came in not being paid, volunteered, who's going to take our time out of our day-to-day lives to come in to work with those men, that was a groundbreaking. So David Eberhardt, I thank him for writing that letter because mm-hmm. it was a long, thought-out letter. And I guarantee if we would have given those men that opportunity to do the same thing, they would have felt the same way that David felt.
David, welcome to the studio.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Let me just add very quickly to some of the things that Lamar talked about. We had a group of about 46 men, ages 28 to 64 years of age. Out of these 46 men, 38 of these men grew up without a father. And so it was particularly painful doing the activity with these young men because at a point on their timeline, each young man identified a place where he really began to realize how much he had lost because daddy rolled out. And so as Lamar talked about, this work with men, particularly men in prison, is so crucial to revitalizing a community because the vast majority of men in this country are nonviolent offenders. I mean, the vast majority of the men in this country that are locked up on drug charges. And so what that says to us is there is a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done with fathers and grandfathers. I mean, Mark and Anthony, I've been going in and out of jails in Maryland for 15, 20 years. I mean, I've met men.
Working.
Yeah. Working. I have met men in their 70s that are locked up.
Right.
I mean, and then when you look at, I know you've had a chance to interview people like Wes Moore. I mean, when you begin to look at the calculated decisions that men are making, you know, Wes went one way and the other Wes went another way, that this is a body of work that desperately needs our attention because so many of our boys are going to prison.
And to add, you know, Congressman Cummings, and I don't know if you guys ever heard the story, he talked about how there was a young man that kept calling him because he said he was being violated in prison, he was doing all these things, and Cummings was able to move this guy around. And so he got this guy to another prison. He tells a story how he got this guy out of prison A to prison B because he felt he was being violated, he was being threatened. So then the guy eventually reached back out to Cummings and said that I lied to you. Those things weren't happening. He said, well, why did you do that? He said, because prison B was where my father is. And I have not spent time with my father. So this guy knew that there needed to be a connection. So he reached out to our congressman to say, can I be moved around? Because I want to be over here next to my dad. That says a lot about a guy who's physically locked up and he's spiritually and emotionally locked up, that he still wants to be connected to his father some form of fashion. And when we talk to many of these men, of course, 90% of them weren't connected with their father. At least 80% of them had literacy issues. Mm-hmm. That's a challenge when we're building prisons based on these third and fourth grade reading levels, that we are in crisis. And if we don't do something about it, then we're going to constantly see this revolving door. And many of the guys kept coming back to prison over and over. That's all they know. And we're not saying, we're not here to give them any excuses, because we tell them, first of all, we know many of you guys have done some, you got some heinous crimes. And many of you guys have been abused, which we found out. A couple of guys have been physically and emotionally abused. So that carried over. So to them, this was the right thing. See, what's normal to the four of us, what's normal to us is not normal to some other folks. You know, not sitting down with your family and eating is abnormal to a group of kids that we work with on a daily basis because they're not used to doing that. Or someone bringing you some food that you know, someone giving you something to drink that's not green or orange or purple, you know, is going down your system. To them is so we have to sort of change that mindset. And you don't know what I'm talking. Anthony, you just had some purple today.
I sure did.
what did you have?
And I'm having some green when I get home.
You had something purple today?
So this work is needed, and we're hoping that it's going to inspire and encourage other men to come into, like I said, we're meeting with them this week, to talk about what it's going to look like. But the fact that these men opened up and says, we want to do it. We didn't come in and say we were going to play, you know, Madden 2011 or some type of video game. We were talking about reading a book and dissecting the book and connecting that book to your life lessons, and to continue to build on what David did when he did that timeline, because we don't want that to slip by, because these guys opened up a can, and we want to come back and we want to focus on some of the things that actually came up.
And you're working with a group of men as well who, whether people will call it something sincere or real or a hustle or a combination of both or somewhere in between and around the barn, men who have made a decision to go into an acupuncture program to at least make a step toward change, whatever that means.
And I think that's significant, very significant. The acupuncture, we know the results of that really does change addicts' lives and their ability to work through their addiction. The other thing that I think Lamar and David both touched on that I don't want to be lost by our listeners, we know, especially we're talking about the black male population, there is a correlation between education level and a lack of a high school diploma and incarceration. There is a strong link between being in a home and being without your father or relationship with your father and your intersection with the criminal justice system. So that just gives us a foundation to begin to intercede early in the life. It's almost like a profile. To intercede early, and that's what David and Lamar have been doing in the lives of boys across this country. We intercede in advance because we know what the profile does. Yes. We know when you don't get that diploma that a huge majority of black men in this country who are incarcerated do not have a high school diploma.
And we could take it a step further. David and I, our company is going to start working with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill Gates and Melinda Gates are giving billions of dollars to children. The issue is they're having issues with getting boys of color to sign up for the. They're paying undergrad to PhD. David and I met with a young man who was a Millennium Scholar who's working for the foundation, who had like a 3.8 grade point average. He said to us his principal in high school only called four of the black students to let them know about the scholarship. He said he knew something was wrong then. He said out of all the people that he knew in school, the principal just handpicked four people. So it's not only the kids who are not doing well academically. We have a system that really don't want black males to succeed, that this is a profit. Making money to hold people down is a profit. You all saw the article in the New York Times. David and I have sent it out about what's going on across the country with boys, the SHOT Foundation. We know it. So we all have to do our part. We all have to do our part to step up to the plate. Even our boys who are doing well, we got to wrap our arms around them because, as I mentioned, this kid we met with last week had a 3.8. He might not have heard about it if he was somebody else.
And the amazing thing, you mentioned Wes Moore a few minutes ago, and I've talked to Wes dozens of times, and we were talking the other day, and he reiterated in a conference call we were on, he said, Anthony, don't lose the fact that but by maybe one decision, mm-hmm. the other Wes Moore could have been that
Wes
Moore.
Right. Yes.
That he had the opportunity to make another decision before it was too late. And too many black boys in this country, too many black men in this country, exhaust those chances.
And to take it a step further, in the book, in the Wes Moore book, when he sits down with Wes Moore, the Rhodes Scholar, sits down with Wes Moore, the guy who was in prison, he asked him, he said, do you think that your environment dictated what happened to you? He said the Wes Moore who was incarcerated paused for a second. He says, I don't know if I agree with that. He said, but I think my expectations. See, if we change the expectations of anybody. See, he said it was expected for me to go to jail. It was expected for me to shoot, to do these things. He said the expectation for you to go to college was there. So you did what was expected of you. These men that we asked, many of them told Dave and I, people expected me to come to jail. So if I would have gone to college, it would have made people surprised. Like, while you went to college, we expected you to do something totally different. So we have to change the expectation. If we can't change the environment, because we definitely can. This city we're in, we don't have enough money to change the environment. But if we could change the expectations of these boys, remember, these people that David and I work with in prison are really little boys dressed up in grown men's clothing. They still have those boys' issues, but we got to change the expectation and raise the bar.
I just want to say, Mark and Anthony, to the listening audience, young black males have to become a priority in Baltimore City for the vitality of this city, for this city to grow and be, you know, recognized as a great city. We cannot get those accolades unless we develop a serious blueprint and plan to support the healthy development of young black males. Because what I think happens very quickly is a lot of times folks are playing with numbers in terms of what's really happening in Baltimore. I just took we have a group in town out of London who's been following us for the last 40 days or so. And what's interesting is The Wire comes on in London two times a week. And as I took these folks from London around Baltimore, it became even more ironic to me that there's sections of Baltimore that look like New Orleans post-Katrina. And if we really want our boys to succeed and grow up and get married and have families and add to, you know, the GNP of this city or to this country, then black boys have to become a priority, not just lip service.
Yeah, I sent you all when I found out Friday over the weekend that you guys were going to be able to come on the show today.
Mm-hmm.
Justin wrote. I sent you all Bob Herbert's op-ed piece in the New York Times on Saturday, and it really does speak volumes to me about what we need to do as a society and where we are with this. I mean, with the crisis that is being faced. One of the things, I mean, that we have a solid majority, as he wrote in the article, of black men without a high school diploma are in or have been to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Not some small number of people.
Right.
And that he pinpoints it, and he's saying that part of it is the amount of criminal activity that is inside the poor black world, working class black world, people involved in criminal activity, ending up in prison. But it also is the insane criminal justice system, mm-hmm. that puts all these nonviolent offenders in prison. The fact that there are no jobs, nothing is going on, and it's falling apart. And it has to. He calls for a new movement from the community out and in, as well as fighting for social justice, as you were saying, to be serious about it. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that part of it is that someone said on my show today. Well, you won't hear that until tomorrow, but. the interview I did today with a man, that one of the things he said was that we're in an America that doesn't care
mm-hmm.
about the dispossessed, especially not about poor black folks in the city. People just don't care, mm-hmm. and that there has to be kind of a movement from a number of different ends at one time to turn this thing around. I mean, it is because we are facing a real crisis.
Yeah, everybody needs to be involved. If we were on a ship and it was going down, we all need to paddle. Mm-hmm. We all need to be involved. Mm-hmm. And when I sent the Facebook message about the article that came out of New York Times, I told people, if you're involved in a boy's life, you know, I'm happy for you. If you're not, you need to be connected to a program because you'll see the difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, I met with another one of my mentees who's at Morehouse College, and I look at this young man who is on it. But he thanked me and David and all these other people who kept him focused. I mean, people who don't share the same blood as him, who don't live in the same neighborhood. But he just thanked us for the calls, the encouragement, the connections. That's all it takes sometimes.
The money.
That's an investment. Believe right. me, I tell our kids, the kids that I taught, I said, you know, when you take me out to lunch, I'm sure it's some money that I've given you years ago. So it's an investment. And we got to think about it that way. We really have to think about that if we invest in these children early, they will definitely take care of us. And I've seen that a lot with the young people that I've come across.
One of the interesting things, David Lamar, about the Herbert article was he oftentimes, and you know, I'm part of a Saturday breakfast club, and it's me and about 15 white people. And the amazing thing about it is I often find myself, as Mark said, with the guest he interviewed today, in this position where I'm really shocked at the level of or the lack of any kind of empathy at all from these white professionals.
Even the groups you're with?
Even the groups I'm with. For
no, I'm saying, you know what I mean?
For black people, especially poor black people in this city. There is this sense of, well, you know what, Anthony? That's about choices. You had a choice. They love using me as an example. I had a choice, and we made choices. These people that you keep talking about, these people that you keep collecting money for, these people that you, and I have this this group of friends who are incarcerated that I send cards and letters to constantly, even if it's just a hey, or I hope you're doing good, or stay encouraged. And so I get my buddies to do that. And they're like, Anthony, that card isn't going to make a difference because he's already there. And they talk about the murders in the city. They said, I don't care that a black person killed another black person because it's probably two drug dealers taking each other out. And I find myself in this constant battle.
Can we come and talk to the good white folks?
I think they would be terrified. But the thing I was getting at is they often say, Anthony, part of the problem is you're asking us to care. When they look at the black community, and I noticed in the Herbert article, he talked about we have to, inside our community, and you talked about expectations, we've got to set a whole different level of expectations that we're quick to say what a movement needs to become, but even within our own community sometimes, there is not this sense that we pull each other up, but that we hold each other accountable for how we're raising our children, the circumstances that we're raising our children in, the circumstances that we're living in. How do we get a message across that you just talked about everybody has a role to play, but most important is the man and the woman who brought that child into the earth, into the world.
And that's the great challenge. We talked about, you know, getting those two people that created this
life.
Child to be on the same page. And as I say to some of the women who get connected with these men, you have to be careful with the person that you choose to have a child with, and vice versa. Men always say, well, she's crazy. She wasn't crazy before the kid, but now that the kid is here, she's actually crazy. we definitely all have to paddle, man. We all have to support one another. The thing is, we all can do something. You can't do everything, but you can do something. And I think that we get so overwhelmed with our day-to-day lives that we tend to forget what you're saying. Words are so powerful. Just for them getting those words, to see these men, for me to give out a book as just a prize, and several men was like, man, how could I get a copy of that? It says a lot. It says that, you know, I made some mistakes, but I want to get myself together because even though they're physically locked down, these men that are incarcerated, they need some support. They definitely need some, you know, keep going, encouragement, those type of things, because they do support each other in that. And these things happen to us in our lives for a reason. They make us who we are. And like I tell people all the time, when David and I went into the prison, don't be surprised if we're going in prison talking to some men. See, we just didn't get caught. They got caught. And that's what it really boils down to. They got caught and we didn't get caught. So we think that we're all scot-free.
Let me make a quick comment, because I know you want to go to the calls. Let us not also forget about the children. I've done a lot of work in both the men's and the women's prison. I was in Jessup Women's Correctional Facility about 6 months ago, and it was very painful seeing mothers and grandmothers that are locked up. And so let us not forget about the children, because it's one thing growing up poor. It's a whole nother thing when you have a mom or dad or mom and dad in prison. And so the last 2 years, man, I've been working on a book called Where's Mommy and Daddy, which will be released in about another 2 weeks, which is really a guide for social workers, for educators, to really be able to go in and do that painful work with those children. Things like preparing a child for visiting day. I mean, even when we go to the prison, it's tough. You know, just getting over the emotional issues of just going in on the other side of the wall, the doors being shut. Imagine a 10-year-old little girl going to visit her mom or her dad. And so a lot of times I don't think that we realize that even when we talk about women, African-American women 18 to 35 represent the fastest growing prison population in America. The issue with women in incarceration is so acute that you have programs in jails across the country where they're opening up. They have daycare centers and they have early child learning centers for these children to be bussed in to work with mom and dad while they're locked up.
And the women don't get near the services of the men.
Yeah.
Men do at all. They're about to build a new facility down there.
It's the same thing here on the outside. I mean, the services for women who are addicted it's abysmal compared to the number of slots you have for men.
Yeah, yeah.
And the numbers of women on the street who work their bodies on the street who are addicted, who are trying to feed children. People just do. It's hard sometimes to get people to understand, because we do have all this personal responsibility thing in America, which is really important. Personal responsibility is very important. And you do want to instill personal responsibility in all the men and women in our society so they can make lives. But people, I think, don't even have an inkling of what people have to live through to survive day to day and what's going on inside these prisons and what's going on that puts people inside these prisons. It's like, you know, Woody says all the time that if you're poor and working class in America, you even if you have a job, you also have your hustle. If you don't have your hustle, you don't survive. And the hustle puts people in jail.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's like something that we don't, it's like never land for people. But a negative never left. Yeah.
And like David said, man, it's a process going through those doors. Because you think about, man, I could have ended up here. You know, somebody prayed for me. Somebody directed me. Literally, when I walk through there, I'm saying to myself, you know, I can't believe I made it. So I have to somewhat give back. And those men know, we hold them accountable. One guy, we got into this big argument because the question David and I asked, how many of you guys are good fathers? And this one young dude raised his hand. I said, how are you a good father? Well, I take care of my kid. Dude, no, you can't. No, you're not. So the older dude's got, but the young, how you going to sit up and tell me I'm not a good father? You are not a good father. If you're here, who's protecting your daughter right now from the sick uncle who done felt on you? That's how you ended up in jail. So we got to bring them to reality, and we don't cut cards with. We're here to support you, but we want you to check us, and we're going to check you. If we want to heal through this process, because remember, as I tell people all the time, when I'm doing these sessions, I'm talking out loud for myself. Literally, I'm going through the same process to really heal myself as well, and I'm working with these men throughout the process.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and go right to the phones, Anthony Will, as soon as we come back. And you just heard Lamar Darnell Shields and David Miller. They are both co-founders of the Urban Leadership Institute. David is the chief visionary officer. Lamar is president. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Michael, you're the first caller up. When we come back, stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm
Anthony McCarthy,
and I'm
and
Mark
you
Stern.
It's Monday, so we're together.
And welcome. We're here with the co-founders of the Urban Leadership Institute, David Miller and Lamar Darnell Shields. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Let us go.
It's great to have them together, Mark. I know we're going to find. Usually we get Lamar or we get David. Now we got both the powerhouses in the house.
It's true. I was so happy to get this finally happen.
We off that vacation. We fired up. We make y'all act a fool. We walk outside.
I was hoping.
Good.
Before we get done with the phone, something I forgot to say that's really important to keep us on the air here and the good people to talk about. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland's Inflammatory Bowel Disease Program, a multidisciplinary care service dedicated to relieving symptoms and improving the quality of life of IBD patients. For more information, the number is 1-800-492-5538. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hey, Michael.
Good, Michael. Welcome.
Good, good, good. So I wanted to say you got to pay some bills, right? And the other thing, you know,
yes, we do.
Look, but when Anthony said these guys are terrified, I tell you what, they're not terrified enough, and they're not terrified of the right things. And I think we have to bring in perspective for these folks, because they're the ones that we have to really work on is an asset-based model, right? Because, you know, if we keep focusing on the liabilities, that's all they're going to see. That said, we need to talk about the liabilities, because the systems that are in place, man, are costing money. You know, this imprisonment, you know, and the cost of imprisonment per prisoner, or when you look at the systemic impact, we have to be making those cases, because that hits them in the wallet. And this is going on, you know, nationwide. The Great Economist article in The Economist about it recently. You guys ought to pick that up. But, I mean, it really lays out the case, you know, that even the incarceration rates aren't having an impact the way they should. And you know, so all the premises are flawed going on is they don't want to believe that we are the true assets that we are beyond our current model, which is fodder to the prison industrial complex. But until that argument is made and that picture is painted, they won't have sufficient fear to want to change allocation decisions and how we, and that's not redistribution of wealth, by the way, but allocation decisions and which assets get invested in. But the way it's going, they can't ignore it for long, and it's going to be big problems. So we have to be able to link that argument to the real story and the real lives that you guys are hitting on the ground. But if we're not linking that argument to the larger systemic thing and making the case, they're always going to see it and be able to paint it and spin it as personal as possible.
Michael, you raise an important issue here, and I think that, you know, while, you know, the work that you do on the ground, I mean, is completely critical in terms of young men and getting fathers to take responsibility and addressing this stuff in the prisons. Also, the larger political question Michael's talking about is as important from the other end,
right?
Because he's right. There is this, I mean, it's a $1 billion industry just to do prison laundry that we have in this country. Not like the private prisons that exist, not the equipment that being built for prisons.
Right.
There's a huge industry that lobbies for more, more, more. And to do that means you have to incarcerate more and more black men, more and more black women, more and more Latino men and women, more and more Native American men and women are going to be locked up in prisons because that's where the dollars are.
Let me just add, because I think Michael raises a very important question, and so do you, Mark. But another piece to this is one of the reasons why we quit our jobs over 12 years ago to start a company is because we realized that there also needs to be an economic infrastructure that allows young black males, low skilled, who may or may not have, you know, the kind of educational requirements that we need. Is that one of the reasons why we decided to go this entrepreneurial route is to be able to put ourselves in a position where we would be able to hire people that look like us. Because one of the challenges is, even if they released everybody from Baltimore City Jail right now, there is absolutely no place that they can work. And so this whole entrepreneurial piece is so critical to this discussion, because so many of these men come home, have changed their lives, and are ready to work, and there are not places where they can get jobs. And what ends up happening is, even for men and women who haven't been to prison, looking at young black males who haven't been to prison, a lot of times it's so difficult for them to get a job, even at a place like McDonald's, that what ends up happening is they end up getting out there hustling, and then they end up going into the system as well.
And so the question, so I think that's why, I mean, you have to hit it from both ends. One of the things that Herbert was saying in his article, you got to hit it from the end of making political change and confronting the system and confronting our political process, as well as the end of getting deeply involved in human beings' lives as the two of you are doing.
And then we also got to tell the positive stories. You know, we got to talk about the young people who have succeeded. We don't tell those stories enough. And that's why whenever I get an opportunity, I'm constantly sharing with the young people that I come in contact with, and even the men who've overcome these obstacles. So we definitely have to share the stories. And also, Mark, a lot of people don't realize, I mean, we read the Schott Foundation's report, and we read the report that David and I have written in from the Maryland State Department of Education. A lot of people don't understand how the dire straits that we're actually in. Mm. They really don't. They really don't understand, especially the boys. They really don't understand what's going on. When we talked about what's happening at City College, where I taught, and what's happening at Poly, the graduation rates are dropping. I would have loved to hear where the boys are in that area, you know, where the boys are, you know, not completing schools, they or going on to college or what have you. So a lot of us don't even know that it's taking place. I look at what took place in Annapolis. NPR did the story on Annapolis High School out there, how they covered this thing up for so long and for so long That's for right. so long, and then to people start to find out that the black kids aren't doing well. It is a crisis. I mean, we are at a crisis because
well, it's beyond
crime
a crisis.
Goes up when we allow these things to happen to our children, and we don't focus a lot of our time and energy on our children at all.
David, then we'll go back to the phones.
I was going to say it was a crisis 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's an epidemic. I mean, it's literally an epidemic. We can go into schools and literally look at children and say literally to ourselves, without a long-term intervention, doing some work with the parents, working with that community, working with their school, that these set of boys are going to go to prison. And some of it is, you know, as Lamar talked about, I mean, there's something that all of us can do. It may not be mentoring. It may not be volunteering. But it could be something as simple as writing a $10 check every month to a church that you go to, or a church that's around the corner from your home that's doing a mentoring program, that has a college readiness program. And so there's a role for each and every one of us.
Let's get back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. And I don't have a name for line two, but why don't we have her on the air? Can we put it on? No? Okay, then let's go to. Mine's up there. Will, you're on the air.
Hello?
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, Will.
Hey, Will.
How y'all doing? Mr. Miller, Mr. Shield, I've met both of you. And I wanted to say that I appreciate, and I think your work should be applauded in bringing a lot of the issues to light that most people don't get to see and they don't hear about. We kind of know, but they don't really know the deep issues and the deep rooted issues that are the causes of a lot of our problems. And I commended Lamar. I commend you one time on the radio when we were talking about the Men to Boys presentation. And I think a lot of that. And I always said, if we could get those kind of presentations into our communities where people really can see what's going on, what our young people are really having to deal with, I think it'll have a profound effect on a lot of our young people. But one of the things that we proposed, and I heard y'all mention how our schools are impacted, how our schools are failing our children, a lot of those things. I think that One of the ideas that had come up, and since some of the schools, I think we have it in 16 schools where we have the community schools program. And I oversaw one at Pimlico Elementary Middle, and it had a profound effect on a lot of the students there. We had no parental engagement to having 65 parents engaged and a lot of after-school activity and things like that. So it totally changed the culture of the school. And I think that things like that and thinking outside of the box, ideas like that, but definitely your work, And all of those things definitely be commended. And I think we need more ideas like that and more innovation to move forward and get our kids into a different situation, different culture.
Yeah, so I'm curious, David Lamar, I mean, how you to think about what you do and what has to do to be expanded, how to make this into what you're trying to do into a massive scale.
I think the majority of the work and the majority of phone calls that we get lately, and David and I meet with principals and superintendents across the country, but the number one call that we get, Mark, the majority of the time, is what can you do to engage boys of color? Tomorrow, and I think on Thursday, I have two workshops that I'm doing with two schools. I mean, this is all, what can you do to engage boys of color? We have a majority white female population who have teachers who haven't come in contact with boys of color, and African Americans who come from that same community. So the biggest thing that we've been focusing on a lot is really providing school system with effective research-driven strategies on how to engage boys of color, because as we look at the research, many of these people are ill-equipped. I mean, there's no book that you can go to. Morgan has a school of education in Coppin. No, there's no book you can go to when a little boy curses you out and says, F you, so and so and so. You know, you can't turn to page 65 and say, this is how you respond to the boy that just cursed you out. No one. But there's some skills that we teach these educators. I mean, they're superintendents. I was talking about cultural competency, and I won't mention the school district, but it's on the Eastern Shore somewhere. I'm talking to the superintendent, and she was like, what does cultural competency mean? What does that mean? I'm like, what? So you don't understand. So now I understand why the staff that you're hiring can't deal with this particular population. The reason why we're qualified is not only because we have the degrees, because David and I were some clowns in class. We were the kids tapping on the desk. We
just added me.
He put you right in there.
He just spoke for you, David. Is that true?
It's true.
But we were those. But we, I heard his teachers testify at a workshop that we did. I remember little David in the classroom. See, that's the beauty about me being from another city.
That's right.
But empirical,
I know a lot of people in Chicago.
Yeah. So I always say my degrees. My empirical data trumps my degrees because I was that little boy, Anthony, that didn't sit still, that ran around, that tapped on the desk. So not only do we research it, but we look at what we needed at the time to engage. Because these boys want to be engaged all the time. But it's how do you structure that?
And let me just answer your question, Mark. One of the things is moving the work to scale. Because we're doing some great work. You got people like Joe Jones is doing some great. I mean, a phenomenal group of folk in Baltimore that are doing great work. And one of the issues is moving the stuff to scale. I'm sure most of you guys are familiar with, you know, Jeffrey Canada's work in Harlem Children's Zone. I know Jeffrey have had, you know, we have had a chance to hook up and kind of talk about this whole notion of moving things to scale. Some of it is there's a resource issue. Because when you look at what Jeff Canada's doing in Harlem, he has like a $76 million budget. Money is not an option for the work that he's doing. He's committed to saving lives and has the resources to get those children in the pipeline when they meet them at Harlem Hospital and create sort of a safety net all the way up to sending those young people that live in that zone to college. What I find in Baltimore is that a lot of times if you're not in the loop, if you are an African-American group, then you are, for the most part, not connected to the funding, even if you do good work. And so one of the challenges is in order to be able to do this work at a higher level, in order to move the stuff to scale, community groups need money. So much money is being spent on just frivolous fly-by-night projects in the city. Money needs to be allocated to community groups. But again, there needs to be a system of accountability. There needs to be a system of being able to measure and document outcomes. Without that, we will continue to have the same kinds of challenges.
But even with that, I've heard both of you talk about the fact that even on a smaller scale, if black men would start to volunteer in their school, their child school, show up at school, or if black men were to gather together and say, that school on the corner, we are going to be at every day. We're going to walk that hall. I'm going to come for my lunch break, and I'm going to walk that hall. I'm going to talk to the teachers. I'm going to talk to the principal. And even with that scale, which sounds Herculean, but it's really small if you're committed to get it done, it's possible. We have a hard time activating people even at that level.
Well, one of the things that we've been trying to get off the ground, Anthony, for a couple of years here in Baltimore is a project called the Million Father March, which is based on some work by a guy in Chicago that we're doing some work with. His name is Philip Jackson. And he's just simply asking for fathers just to walk your children to school. Just show up. Attend a PTA meeting. Do something in the school on your day off. And I think what has to happen is we just have to amplify our voices. We got to make more noise. Those of us of like minds have to continue to push a little harder. But you know, the reality is a large percentage of the citizenry in Baltimore is more concerned about the Ravens and whether or not the Ravens are going to go to the Super Bowl. Are more concerned with that than the fact that you might have 13 people shot in a weekend.
Let me open the phones here again. We had a lot of people calling in, but I think they got tired of waiting. So let me ask you to call back at 410.
Patience.
319-8888. People, we lack that. In this world. 410-319-8888. It's all immediate. That's part of the problem. We just lost another one. So let's go to Elliot, who is hanging on via thread here. Elliot, you're on the air.
Thanks, Elliot.
Yeah. Salaam alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
I just want to thank the brothers for all of their hard work that they're doing in the prison. I'm also a volunteer in the Maryland State Prison for the Nation of Islam. And through the work of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, we have been able to reach many of the young brothers that have literally appeared to have run wild in the prison, mainly because the street organizations are what people call gangs. But now we're finding a gravitational pull in the teachings, as we're taught by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, to change the thinking of these young men. So once we can change the way they think, we can also change the way they act. So I want to just, I guess, thank all of the brothers that are working hard and diligently throughout the prisons in the state of Maryland and abroad for helping the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan reach out to these young men, as well as older brothers, but especially to the young brothers that are in these street organizations and bringing them closer to the knowledge of themselves. The messenger has taught us that the more we read, the more we study, the more we learn about who we are. And unfortunately, because I spent a lot of time in prison too, but unfortunately, a lot of these young men, they don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. As men, they don't know their background. They don't know their history. They're given false images. You know, so what the Nation of Islam has done, it's literally given them an identity. And most of the young men, now that they have embraced manhood, they see what it is to really be a man.
Thank you. You know, it's interesting. He talks about manhood. Twice a year, David and I lead a retreat, and we have a retreat coming up for boys. So any moms or teachers or aunts or uncles who are looking for something, we have a Dare to Be Keen weekend retreat that's going to take place in Annapolis. We have an open house, Mark, actually, on Wednesday at the Bon Secours Urban Medical Institute at 6 o'clock. And it's open up to any boy, you know, ages 11 to 17. We took a group of boys last year. David took the older boys. I took the younger boys. This year we're going to merge two groups together. But any mom or dad or any teacher that's looking that wants their son to talk about manhood, we sort of remove them from the environment. We take them out into the woods, and there's some things that we deal with while we're out there. But our open house is going to be this Wednesday at the Bon Secours Urban Medical Institute, which is on 3100 Tawanda Avenue, right near the Mondawmin Mall. So anybody that's listening who wants to send a young person there, this is always a great opportunity and an entree into the other things that we do. You know, we took a group of boys to Puerto Rico this past summer to do some community service projects. Kids, many of them have never flown before, but we want to give them that experience to see how other people are struggling of color, who look like them, who can't get a hand up. So our goal is to expose not only just these older men that are in prison, but the parents with the Raise Them Alone campaign that David has created through the Open Society Institute, and then through this retreat that we have taking place in October. But any mom or dad that's listening, show up on Wednesday at 6 o'clock at the Bon Secours Urban Medical Institute, the West Pavilion. That's right near BCC. If you want to be a part of this retreat that we have taking place, which is somewhat similar to what the guy just called in talking about.
In the last 4 or 5 minutes we have left, I want to bring it back to where we began and to talk about the importance of the work inside, mm-hmm. David, that we were talking about as you were driving up, the work going on inside the jails with the men who are coming home, because 80%, 90% of the men who are in jail are coming back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it's critical that we figure out a way to get more groups to be willing to, say, adopt a unit or a tier or a group of men
That's
in the facility. I know that there's a lot of church groups that are going in, and so there's a lot of work actually being done by churches. Well, I think what's equally important is there needs to be life skill development. There needs to be work around forgiveness, because one of the things that Lamar had the men do is write a letter to your father forgiving him for leaving. It was just a really, really,
oh, really?
Emotional. I mean, it was literally gut-wrenching for these men to write letters to their fathers, you know, forgiving them for leaving. And it was extremely emotional. And we walked around and we helped men. And so there's a lot of soul searching. There's a lot of life planning that needs to go on before these men are released. And that's the kind of work that we're really advocating for.
But just to even reflect on that piece about the letter to their dads, I mean, one guy, David, literally had to walk him through how to spell words, and he was asking David, I mean, he was some serious words. He was asking David about things that had happened to him, and we just looked at it, because I have the letters, and I was reading them, like, how could, you know, how do you survive a situation like that? You know, you should have ended up either here or in an insane asylum based on the letter that you've written to your father, that I can understand why you did what you did based on the things that have happened to you in your life. So even just something, we talked about words being powerful, Anthony, for a man to sit down and write a letter to say, "Dear Dad, I forgive you for A, B, C, and D," or "Dear Dad, I'm sorry that I let you down." Because everybody that's incarcerated didn't have that issue with the dad rolling out. It was some other issues that they dealt with. But those are the things that we're going to challenge these men with. And if you want to be a part of what we're doing, definitely look us up. You know, give us a call. But we're serious about this work. Again, we're going to start with this book club, and we're hoping that it's going to open up. I'm excited that the staff that are there are real excited about what we're doing. The library is going to participate with us, so we're going to get these books donated. But this is just a start to having these conversations about serious things that these men are dealing with.
Lamar Darnell Shields, David Miller, I thank you both for the work that you do and Urban Leadership Institute.
Thank you.
And
thank
it's
you.
Always a pleasure to have you in the studio. I want to have you back as soon as the book comes out.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll talk about that. Anthony McCarthy.
Great to be with you, Mark.
Thank you, brother.
Always great to be with you.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Daniel Gillespie and Richard Good. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, and find out information about our guests, as you will today on our website, to find out more about the Urban Leadership Institute, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.